This time up is our guest Paula Thompson on Candidly Speaking. Paula is the director of Urantia Fellowship in Boulder, Colorado. The fellowship maintains urantiabook.org, and Paula has been among the driving forces for outreach ministry for well over three decades. Paula shares with us the current growth and reception of the Urantia Papers and shares her insight on why she thinks the teachings are beginning to make a huge impact around the world. Paula is also the co-host of Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. She, along with fellow host Christy Lynn Larson, have been hosting Cosmic Citizen for over a decade. The show airs every Saturday from 12 to 2 p.m. Eastern on Blog Talk Radio. And Paula joins us, this time up on Candidly Speaking. How long have you been the host for Cosmic Citizen?
I've been a co-host since August of 2008.
Wow, so we're talking over almost 7 years. 7 years this month? Last month?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And you
doing
and Christy Lynn.
Shows.
And what...
Actually, I started with Andre Traversa. And Andre is somebody who really likes radio a lot. I mean, he's blind and...
He's out of Chicago, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
And he loves talk radio, and it's like the thrill, listening to talk radio for him is, he told me once, is like somebody else watching the Friday night fights, a sighted
right.
person.
Mm-hmm.
And he loves controversy. And so, you know, although we started this show, we didn't want to embrace a whole lot of controversy. Andre really liked to kind of bring that in if he could.
Sure.
He quit reading the Urantia book. He's gone back and forth now a couple of times where he believes it and then he doesn't and then he does and then he doesn't. So he's in a phase now where he doesn't believe in it anymore, and he's actually renounced it on the air. So,
how funny.
Yeah. So he may never come back. Who knows? But anyway, he left the show and he turned it over to me. I think we had been doing it for maybe about a year and a half when that happened. And then... Crystalline became my co-host, and then Crystalline invited Andre Rodatis. So now it's the three of us every week.
And do you find that, and we talk about this all the time, and we talked about it before this interview, the technology today gives the ability for the teachings and the fellowship to grow exponentially, and I would imagine that you have found more people listening to your show, which airs on Saturday noon to 3 on Blog Talk Radio. And have you found, or are you seeing a growth in the amount of people that are listening, or has it stayed relatively the same, or has it declined?
Well, you know, it depends on what we're doing a show on. You know, we have somebody like Brian McLaren on, whom we have coming up. Again, Brian's going to be a repeat guest on our show. And Brian is a beloved leader in the emergent Christian community and a prolific writer and a very good writer and a very good thinker. And he has quite a following. So we had, I think 7,000 people listen to that show.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and then we have on a regular, I mean, I think we have at this point in time 190,000 listens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not bad.
Right.
You know, it's all relative, I guess.
Well, we're on the edge of this great revelation in the sense that certainly there's more activity going on with all the different groups. I mean, even on my radio site, urantiaradio.com, there's a, and on your site as well. And by the way, for those who've just joined us, so we're talking with Paula Thompson, who is the director of urantiabook.org, the fellowship website. And even on your website, you have a page that's solely dedicated to all of the different websites that are in existence. So there's definitely a proliferation, but we haven't reached that critical mass. So me being the curious person that I am, I'm trying to anticipate when that critical mass will occur. And one way to watch it grow is you see that there's more activity all kind. 10 years ago, this didn't occur, and I think that technology is what is fueling the current growth of the Urantia book. Would you agree, or would you want to add to that statement?
Well, it certainly is. You know, the Urantia book is considered a spiritual bestseller. It was published in 1955, and I think the most recent estimates are that there's approximately 750,000 to 800,000 books in print. That's books in print, in all languages. And then you have to look at an intangible, which is the advent of the internet, and what actually happened when the book was taken out of copyright in 2002. Because the internet came on pretty strong in the late 90s, and certainly people could access the book, but there were still some stringent copyright restrictions in place over the book at that time. But since 2002, since the copyright has been free, there's literally been nothing stopping people from sharing it liberally on the World Wide Web. And it has proliferated across the web since then. If you search, just do a simple Google search for the word Urantia, you'll see that there's thousands of sites come
hundreds
up
of thousands
that, that mention the Urantia book and even have the entire text online available for free to read. So how do we know how many people now have seen it, read it, been exposed to it? Not only that, but YouTube, there's a proliferation of on YouTube of the various audio papers. The book is available in audio from two different publishers now, and those audio files are free to download and listen to. Who knows how many times they've been shared, how many times that... you know, somebody has downloaded an audio paper on a podcast and shared that with their friends who shared it,
Right.
It's there's no way of knowing how many people now have been exposed to these teachings one way or the other. And what's the critical mass? We've always thought, you know, maybe a million readers, a million people who are reading it actively. And we may be really reaching that.
It's I often say to myself, it's the greatest story never told.
Right.
I mean, because it's out there. So, like you say, it's everywhere. And yet the mainstream ignores it or isn't aware of it or doesn't take it seriously. And I suppose that begs the question, why do you suppose, or what do you think is the stumbling block? What's the last obstacle before the masses start saying, wait a minute, we may be onto something here?
Well, for me, the stumbling block is simply the fact that people don't know what's in it. Once they read it, in my experience, and I hear, you know, I've been doing public outreach since 1982. I think I was telling you the other day, I've gone all over the world now introducing people to the Urantia book, to almost every continent on Earth. I think there's only one that I haven't been to where I've introduced the Urantia book to people. What I find is that, and I hear the same story all the time, you know, we hear from new readers all the time that are just, they contact us and they say, oh my God, what is this thing? This thing is, you know, blowing my mind. It's answering all the questions I ever had. It's moving me so deeply. I'm enthralled. I'm enraptured with this thing. You know, that's a real typical response from somebody who is actually reading it, actually experiencing it. But the stumbling block is you've got this gigantic book. It's a tome, really. I mean, it's you know, 2,000 pages plus. And you put it on somebody, and they open it, and they just, you know, look at the table of contents, or they might thumb through, and it's deep. And so you really have to be spiritually hungry to read that book. You really have to want to know the answers to those great spiritual, philosophical questions to read that book. It's not a casual read or a light reading. And I think people instinctively know, wow, this is a commitment to read this. This is going to change my life if I read this.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not hungry for that, that's the one thing that I see that every reader that I've met, every new reader, every potential reader I've met has in common. They're very hungry for the truth. They're very hungry for information.
The stumbling block, there's two common stumbling blocks that I've observed, mostly in the way that people write about the book. One is that the people that are strictly adhering to their own faith, or they have their own, you know, set of beliefs that they hold dear to, conservative, fundamentalists, whatever you want to call them, those people tend to look at the book as Gnostic or science fiction. Then you've got another group of people who, in the words of a good friend of mine, who is more or less, I would say, more of a humanist, you know, didn't really adhere to any particular, you know, religion. And I gave him the book and he handed it back to me after a couple of days. And he goes, you know, I don't want to divest myself into this book because I'm never going to know for sure whether it's true. So why do I want to waste my time? So you have people who, like you say, are not hungry for it, or it's too much. And then on the other side of the camp, you have people who are maybe just satisfied with what they believe and they don't need anything else other than what they have. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not like our goal here is to convert every human being on the planet, because the fact is everybody has a different path. What's exciting about this is that this is so revolutionary, so new, and it answers so many questions about our history that my attraction to the book, like a lot of people, was just the depth of narrative. I mean, even the story of Adam and Eve, it seems to address every hypothesis that everybody's, I mean, you have people from, what's that one religious group that believes that Adam and Eve were extraterrestrial? Well, to a certain degree, they were, but not in the way that I think the Aryans, or I can't remember the name, some strange group. But anyway, then you've got the people who, you know, like the Eric von Danikins of the world, right? And they're the ones that think that we at one time had been visited by space aliens, and they were this. It's kind of partly right if you adhere to the Urantia book presentation. Yes, we were visited, but we're always visited, and we're visited by spiritual personalities, not necessarily flesh and bone personalities, little green men from other worlds. So that's what I found fascinating, is that it did seem to answer a lot of the missing questions or the missing answers from our history. And that is why I think I found it, not to mention the fact that it emphatically states a lot of scientific and historical statements that at the time it was written, we didn't know was true. And even now, you know, so there's all kinds of fun things to go about on enjoying this book. But I think you're right. If you're not hungry for it, it's like if a horse isn't thirsty, you can lead them to water, but they're not going to drink.
Well, and, you know, I had a great insight about this. Reading the book, The Jesus Papers, again, and they are incredibly insightful. And they're presented by a group of beings who, I'll say supposedly presented, because what you described is somebody who's skeptical. And I understand that's the other big group. People are skeptical. I don't know who wrote it. I know nothing about it. You know, I've seen things on the web that say it's this, it's that. I don't think I have time for it. It's too much. How do I know if I can believe it? I think that's a real legitimate question. And the only thing that I can say to people like that is just read it and decide for yourself if you think it rings with truth or not. But even then, we look for credibility. You know, the first question people ask is who wrote it, that kind of thing. But I had this insight because in the experience that we do with outreach, and we do outreach all over the world through our international committee, this is Urantia Book Fellowship, through our international committee, through our interfaith committee, and through our outreach committee. Our outreach committee reaches out domestically, interfaith reaches out to other faiths, and international reaches out internationally. And I've been to 5 parliaments of the world's religions in different places around the world. And my good friend Buck Weimer is the chair of the International Committee, and he sends groups of people all to Korea and South America, you know, places like Ecuador and Guatemala, to do book fairs. And when we went to South Africa to do the Parliament of the World's Religions, we were reaching out to some very poor people. And what I have found in that kind of outreach, and from other people I know who have reached out in countries like, you know, poor, more impoverished countries, is that the people there see it and they almost immediately know. If they just taste a little bit of it, if they crack it open and start to read, they're enthralled. They're absolutely enthralled. It is not difficult to do outreach in other, in, you know, mm-hmm. say the third world.
Now, I've heard over and over.
They are really hungry for it.
It's almost
really,
as if
really.
South America, what was it, South America, maybe, well, you're saying Africa, those are the hot spots, right? Mexico, Latin American countries, they're really going crazy over this, aren't they?
Well, where we can get it in, mm-hmm. yes. And the point that I'm making is that it's not hard, and here's why. There's a great quote in the book from the equivalent of Mota, which is a deep philosophical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And
so stereoscopic view of reality, I think, is how they describe it, right?
Yeah. One of the motas is that the stars are best discerned from the lonely experiential depths and not from the ecstatic mountaintops. And when we in the Western world have been on the ecstatic mountaintops for a long time. We've been in a feast of information coming in from everywhere. It's a glut. We're in the sound bite generation where everything is a series of sound bites, and you know, this book looks like, wow, you know, that's a lot. And the insight that I got from reading the Jesus Papers was from when Jesus was teaching about the Beatitudes, and he says to the apostles, blessed are you if you hunger and thirst, for you shall be fed. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about being hungry. And I'm going to find this quote for you, because what was so valuable as an insight to me was the fact that the midwayers, the beings that wrote these papers, the Jesus Papers, give the most wonderful commentary on what, you know, Jesus said.
Mm-hmm.
And let me share this with you. Happy are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled.
Yeah.
Then the midwayers give us this commentary. Only those who feel poor in spirit will ever hunger for righteousness. Only the humble seek for divine strength and crave spiritual power. But it is most dangerous to knowingly engage in spiritual fasting in order to improve one's appetite for spiritual endowments. Physical fasting becomes dangerous after 4 or 5 days. One is apt to lose all desire for food. Prolonged fasting, either physical or spiritual, tends to destroy hunger. That insight right there.
Yeah.
Because I pondered when I read this, it wasn't that long ago, maybe in the last 2 years that I read this again, and I had this insight about why those in the third world are so hungry for these spiritual truths in the Urantia book, and why those of us in the first world or the developed nations are not. And it's because, and why we see these trends, I've noticed these trends, and I've heard a lot about the trends in Europe towards atheism and secularism. They're becoming increasingly godless. America, not so much, but still, America is definitely satiated with an idea of the religions of authority, and we don't need to know anything else. And that in itself is also a form of spiritual fasting, to say, I don't need to know anything new. I don't need to have anything else, as a form of spiritual fasting. And what I realized was the reason that it is so hard to get people in the developed world to pick up the Urantia book and give it a chance is because they have been fasting spiritually for so long, they literally have no appetite for the things that are in this book.
I'll add to that that the and I'm agreeing with everything you say, but I also think there is a tendency that either we've become so secularized already by our culture that we don't give ourselves time to seek the eternal realities, which is
there you go,
right? Which is really where it starts. You have to consciously want to know the truth. The truth isn't going to come at you. You have to go for it. You have to want it. And I don't think people, especially in this age of moral relativism, what is truth? You know, there is no truth. There's no absolute truth.
Right.
You hear this saying,
right.
Well, there has to be some truth. There are some absolutes. Gravity is an absolute. It's not partially true. It is true.
Values. I mean,
values are true.
What do we value as human beings? Do we value love? Mm. Is that relative? Can we say, well, maybe not.
Right.
We don't really value love. Do we value loyalty, altruism, truthfulness, trustworthiness,
right.
Honesty?
Yeah, basically the fruits of the Spirit, right? You've just described, I think, all of them.
Or are they
right.
relative? And we say, well, we don't. You know, I only value truthfulness sometimes. I only value loyalty sometimes. You know, no, those are everlasting values that we all could agree. What do we love about a person? We love that they're loyal, honest, trustworthy, kind, compassionate, sincere, honest. You know, this is what we love and what we value in life and what we value in each other. And I often tell people, you know, the way to get in touch with your values is to think about what you want people to remember you for when you're gone. Do you want them to say, well, he had a great house, didn't he? And I loved the car he drove.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want them to say, oh, she always dressed impeccably?
Well, some people actually want that. That's the sad part, is that they want their legacy to be a material thing instead of, I suppose it is.
And yet,
mm-hmm.
when you're at a funeral, what you hear people say is not, oh, she dressed impeccably. You hear people say, she was so kind to me. She was always there when I called.
Hmm.
I love the way that she listened when I had something in my heart that I wanted to share. You know, they don't share.
Right.
People at funerals eulogizing somebody else typically don't mention their material value.
Right.
You have so much money.
Yeah, those are not the eternal realities, right? Let me ask you this, and I want to, I always try to keep these things under 30 minutes because I think in our ADD society, that's about as much as I can expect from people. celebrities, people who are within the Urantia, they read the book. When do those people start feeling like they can tell other people about it publicly? I think there's still a sort of a closet mentality when it comes to, you know, people that we know read the Urantia book, but outside of, I think maybe Carlos Santana had a blurb on it once on his Facebook
uh-huh.
page.
Uh-huh.
Probably the one who's out there the most is Pato Bonten, who's been on this program many times. When do you think, your estimation is, people will start feeling comfortable enough to share the fact that they actually read this book and they're open about it? And of course, that will have a positive influence in some ways because it will introduce other people to it that like, you know, celebrities who endorse things, you know? So what did you...
Well, when they feel that they no longer have anything to lose by openly admitting that they read this book that has no known human author, and it's deeply profound and spiritual, and they believe it. When they have nothing to lose by admitting that.
Well, you know, see, Jackie Gleason mentioned the book on Johnny Carson in 1960.
He did, right.
And Johnny told me, shh. And my dad told me about that. And my dad didn't even know what the book was until I introduced it to him in the early 90s. So the fact that my dad even remembered the book is an interesting thing. But, you know, I think it's almost like on the same level as maybe Scientology. People, you know, that read it are kind of embarrassed a little bit because if they had to explain it, it would make them sound like they were crazy.
Right. Well, and, you know, that's just it. It's got that one question that's so hard to answer. Who wrote it?
Who wrote it, right.
And
maybe we need to come up with a better answer.
Well, and I'll tell you what launched A Course in Miracles, and now it has, I think, 2 million readers worldwide, was Oprah Winfrey had Marianne Williamson on her show.
Right.
When she wrote the book Return to Love.
Mm-hmm.
And Oprah...
Is that book still in fashion? I heard it was... It's funny, what people say about the Arantxa book, oh, it's just a bunch of made-up stuff. I kind of feel that way about A Course in Miracles. What's your take on A Course in Miracles?
Well, I've read both.
And?
And I find that A Course in Miracles is a how-to. I think Jesus said, whenever two or more are gathered in my name, I am there in the midst of them. I think that Helen Schuckman and her associate asked a simple question. They asked, we've been colleagues for years, why can't we love one another? And I think an answer was given them, and it was very specific. This is why you can't love one another. And so the Course in Miracles is a very specific course on how to love and how to forgive and how to see people as God sees them, how to heal human relationships. That's the Course in Miracles. It's a how-to.
But it was written by human beings, correct?
Well, but they didn't claim, they're not claiming they wrote it. They say that Jesus dictated it and they let it come through them.
Mm.
And the author actually does claim to be Jesus in the Course in Miracles. What I know about the Course in Miracles is that it is very effective at helping people learn to love one another and learn to forgive one another. The Arantxa book, on the other hand, and I've read the Course in Miracles once, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's not the Arantxa book for me. The Arantxa book is a how come. It's not a how to.
That's a good one. That's a great way to put it. Right.
Yeah. The Course would talk about how the error so great and the separation, the great separation from God. The Arantxa book will fully explain how that happened and why we came to be separated from God. And it brings about this total understanding of our relationship with God and the universe and who we are, you know, our destiny. Why this world is messed up in the first place. Why these things happen anyway. Why do we find it so hard to forgive each other and love each other? The Arantxa book explains that in such a way that's so satisfying that you just naturally let go of that anxiety about that and you just naturally learn to love your fellows more. And by the time you get to the life and teachings of Jesus in the Arantxa book, if you didn't let go of some of that stuff before then, you're surely going to let go a major portion of it after you read about this incredible life
mm-hmm.
that was lived on behalf of humanity and the words he spoke and the things he did and his wisdom and his insight and, oh my gosh, if you didn't love God before you read the life and teachings of Jesus from the Arantxa book, you would most certainly love him dearly after you read that. And of course, the first five papers of the Arantxa book are all about God and his nature and how loving he is. And there's just nothing else like it on earth. There's nothing I've ever encountered that so sublimely answers your questions about God and the universe and Jesus and angels and creation and order, you know, origin, history, destiny. It's just all there. And so, maybe if an Oprah Winfrey recommended it, then millions of people would pick it up. But I still think that they'd have to be very hungry
right.
to read it.
Right. It's not for everyone. I think the Dalai Lama said, rice grows in China and potatoes grow in America. And sometimes that's just the way it is, different right. folks for different strokes for different folks. So on that note, Paula Thompson, the director of the fellowship, and also urantiabook.org, which is an incredible website. It's a great resource. We'll have you back on again in the future. We'll talk about the Yaya movement. I want to get more into some of the secondary works that you've run across that you think are worth bringing to the attention of this radio audience. And I thank you so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure, Tim. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you having me.
Again, a thank you to the always wonderful Paula Thompson from Urantia Book Fellowship, the organization behind the website urantiabook.org. I invite you to check out the site and enjoy its vast resources. Kudos to the team in Boulder. And I hope you've enjoyed our time on Candidly Speaking with Paula Thompson.